Welcome to In the Wake with Whitley. Here on this podcast, we cover mental health, life lessons, mindset growth, and tons of storytelling. Together, we'll laugh, we'll cry, and everything in between. I'm your host, Whitley Rogers. I'm a certified life coach and mental health advocate. I'm also a survivor of sexual and mental abuse. I'm here to open up those conversations that are normally uncomfortable or hush-hush in society. Keep listening for bits and pieces of my personal journey and insights, along with other interviewees. This is a trigger warning to preface this episode. This episode may include explicit content, graphic details, or heavier, sensitive, and mature topics. We may discuss eating disorders, body dysmorphia, restricting or binging habits. Listen at your own risk and take precaution if you are suffering or recovering from an eating disorder, body dysmorphia, self-harm, or addiction. The following episode could contain such content. The last thing I would want is for this episode to trigger or provoke negative thoughts or feelings. Please practice self-care by choosing to listen in doses, listen with a trusted friend, or skip this episode entirely. All right, I am back here today with a guest to talk a little bit about ADHD and eating disorders and how they intersect and affect one another. And I'm super excited to dive into this topic and learn from her and her lived experience. So with that being said, I'll let you introduce yourself a little bit. So who are you and what is your story?
I am Brianne Leeson. I am an artist and small business owner and creator of an audio drama podcast. I'm from Dallas, Texas. And this year at 30 years old, I was diagnosed with dual type ADHD.
Interesting. So what made you go in to see if you had that diagnosis, I guess? What were the things leading up to that?
I'd like to say that it started more in the fall, but looking back on it, it was almost as soon as the pandemic really hit. My routine was in shambles. And I'm always someone who's been overwhelmed, but I started just being chronically overwhelmed. And the things that I used to have a routine for, like cleaning and just the things that you do as a human being, I was having problems with. And it really became an issue when I realized I hadn't been able to make any visual art unless I had a specific commission for this entire year. So one of my favorite comic book artists posted that he couldn't make art. He didn't know why he wasn't able to draw. And he went in to get screened for ADHD and he got diagnosed at 40.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he got diagnosed at 40. And I was like, that's weird. He can't make art either, but it's wild that it was ADHD. That's probably not me. And then he posted a comic and the comic was about this is what it's like to try to do basic things when you have ADHD. And I thought, well, isn't that how everyone's brain works?
Right.
That's not exclusive. And then I started having these meltdowns. My frustration threshold has always been really small, really short. I have road rage where I come up with new and inventive curse words I didn't know I knew. I can't drive to the post office without flipping somebody off and it's just blocks away. But my meltdowns were just something different entirely. And they reminded me of things that happened when I was a child. And I would be frustrated and I would get the impulse to throw something or kick something. Or as a kid, I would get in fights sometimes. But as an adult, I'm like, no, hurting people's bad. I had so many of these meltdowns and I was tired of causing property damage in my own home that I was like, something's wrong. I'm not depressed. This isn't anxiety because I have anxiety, not an anxiety thing. I don't know what the problem is.
Right.
So I spoke to a friend and told him what was going on. He was like, that kind of sounds like the meltdowns I get with my ADHD sometime.
Mm-hmm.
There's that ADHD thing again. Huh, weird. And I talked to my therapist about it. And my therapist goes, I have ADHD, right? No. He's like, I think you need to get screened. And my therapist knew me as a teenager also and was like, and knowing you as a teen, I'd say, yeah, I think you might have ADHD.
Really?
Yeah. So I had one screening with a doctor who was just a bad doctor and was perpetuating basically a lot of the really misogynist myths that keep people who are assigned female at birth from getting diagnosed. And was like, I just think you're depressed because of these these things, try this medication you just told me you don't do well on. I was like, that's not it. That's not the right answer for me. Then I was desperate and my husband was like, hey, I found this ADHD exclusive clinic. They'll see you virtually. I filled out the screening. It took me a couple hours. It was thorough. It goes from how much did you weigh when you were born to what did you do last week?
Wow.
Yeah. So detailed. And as I filled it out, it almost felt like it was made specifically for me. There were so many questions where it's like, were you born prematurely? Do you have a low birth weight? Are you in the visual arts? You play an instrument? Did you ever skip a grade? And I was like, I'm answering yes on too many of these. I'm doing this wrong. I guess my answers were alarming enough that they called me the next day. Hey, we sent you the form. You have an official diagnosis. It's severe enough. The doctor's booked out quite a while, but she wants to see you tomorrow.
Wow.
And after the talk with the doctor, I cried because she was like, I bet you've been feeling this. I bet you've been feeling that. And it's not your fault. This year's been hard on everyone. And she said, I inadvertently was doing all these other things that are good for people with ADHD, just with my routine. You are the kind of candidate who is already doing the things I want people to do before they try medicine. And I think this is going to change your life.
Wow. I think that's also really cool that it started by someone else sharing their story and being open about it, that kind of created this spark in you, or just this curiosity to even question, like, what is going on? You know, not everyone works this way, because that kind of self-discovery or self-awareness can be hard. And I'm sure many people go throughout their entire life without getting a diagnosis or coping with these things in a way that works for them. So I think that's amazing that you're finally have that, those answers, so that you can understand yourself better.
Yeah. And that's part of why, like, okay, well, I'm going to talk about it now, because somebody else talking about it got me to get screened and got me to get help. And it has changed my life immensely. People who are assigned female at birth, especially millennials, generally don't get their diagnosis till later in life, because for a while it was thought that little girls don't get this. And both my psychiatrist and my therapist said, people who are assigned male at birth are given this leeway of, well, boys will be boys. You're supposed to be hyperactive. You're supposed to be kind of aggressive. You're supposed to be flighty. No one really expects you to do well at school. You're supposed to be loud. You're supposed to take up space. And we live in a world that tells girls and women, that's exactly what you're not supposed to be.
Yeah. Let's continue talking and unpacking that. What are these myths and misunderstandings or just ignorant beliefs that you feel people have regarding ADHD?
Well, the number one thing is that ADHD isn't real. A lot of people think it's just some moral failing or laziness, and they think it was just invented to sell meds. And you have older people who are like, well, it didn't exist back in my day. But ADHD is genetic. It's hereditary. It is a neurobiological developmental disorder. I hate that the word disorder is with it, because the more I learn about it, the more it's just a difference, just not a disorder. And the gene is largely traced to hunter-gatherer, like nomadic people. Mm-hmm. It is some leftover sort of neurodivergence that helped humanity survive. So when people started becoming farmers and staying in one place, it wasn't as common, but you still have, like, I think it's 5 to 8% of the global population who still have this gene. So it's poorly named. Is the other one. I don't have a deficit of attention. I have a real problem focusing that attention where it needs to go. Some people will say, well, you focused on this thing. You must not have ADHD. Our focus is interest-based, so we can't really control what we're focusing on. I think the other myth is that it's a mental illness. It's just a way someone's brain is wired. There are a lot of comorbid mental illnesses that people with ADHD are prone to having. But what I'm discovering, largely in part, it's because they've not gotten any help, not gotten any treatment, and they're being forced to try to fit into this neurotypical framework that is not made for how our brains are wired.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I'd say that it's not good. It's not bad. It just is. I think any type of brain is not going to be any better than the other. So it's not a huge deficiency. It's not something you grow out of. People think kids just grow out of it. It's visible on brain scans that you still have it. Like, it's measurable. You can see it. It's not caused by sugar or video games. Like some people think, people with ADHD really like both of those things because we're low on dopamine and those give you a dopamine hit. And ADHD means you aren't intelligent and you can't do work in school. The first doctor said, well, you have a college degree. You've kept a job. That's not common with ADHD. That's false.
Those are just myths.
Exactly. And it depends on what that job is or what that schooling is. If it's something right. Someone's interested in, ADHD people can do incredible things.
Right.
just a lot of myths. And I didn't even know it was a developmental thing when I went to go get screened.
I like that you emphasize that it's not a disorder and it's not something that's wrong with you. I think society has made you and others that have ADHD to believe that, you know, something is wrong with them because they don't fit into this generalized system that we've created that doesn't work well with ADHD type brains. That's just unfair. It's an unfair playing field. The school system, the education system generally doesn't work well with your brain. And so I like that you kind of neutralized it, that it's not something that's wrong with you. It's just that your brain functions differently and it's wired differently, but different isn't bad.
It's not bad. And there's a doctor I really like, Dr. Ned Halliwell. He's one of like world experts on ADHD, and I've been reading all sorts of stuff, and he has it also. And he uses the analogy that ADHD brains are like a Ferrari with bike brakes. So you've got all this power and it can do great things, but there's also some danger because you can't stop in time when you need to. Mm-hmm. So there are some real risk factors, but again, there are for neurotypical brains as well. Mm-hmm. But the neurotypical brain has a world that is made to focus on their deficits and
right, and work in their favor.
Exactly.
So because we're going to also cover eating disorders and how your ADHD has played a role in this, what do you believe are the myths, the misunderstandings, and ignorant beliefs around eating disorders?
I think the number one is that eating disorders are always visible. I've had a lot of friends who, when I've expressed like, oh my God, my ADHD meds have helped my eating disorder stuff so much. They're like, what? I didn't know you had issues with food. I never looked like super thin, but right. I think it was bad and it's not always visible. You don't just grow out of it. That's why in recovery is the term that's used, not recovered. I think I would compare it to probably what alcoholics would understand, like, it's a day-by-day thing and you just take it as you go.
Yeah.
That eating disorders only happen to women. They don't care about gender. That it's only thin folks. And also that the core of an eating disorder is just looking a certain way. I mean, I did grow up when it was like, oh, heroin chic was the way you wanted to look. I think it's more of an issue of control when you feel you have none.
Yes, I've heard that, the battle with control or feeling out of control. I've heard that over and over with different guests that I've interviewed. So that makes sense.
And when I think about when the disordered thoughts start cropping up again, or the one time I did relapse, it's times when I felt out of control.
You're so right. Like, there's just not a look. There's not a look to ADHD. I mean, it makes sense to be able to like diagnose. They have this checklist and it makes sense, but it also is hard to put these types of things into a box when it's just complex and there's many factors and layers to it and everyone's experience looks a little bit differently. So yes, there's not a look, and any gender, any race, any size can experience a hard relationship with food, where they're battling this control and using food to cope or feel in control. So let's dive into that a little deeper. What has your relationship with food and your body looked like throughout your life?
It's been kind of fraught with conflict, I think, from the beginning. There are comments that would get made when I was a little kid. I was a chubby little kid. I was healthy, but I was a chubby little kid. So they're not mutually exclusive. And part of my family is Puerto Rican, and I would get called gordita, comments on my panza, which is a little tummy. And just culturally, it was just a nickname or just a comment. But right. You think about those things and they stick with kids. But it started getting bad. I was an early bloomer and I started kind of putting on just that weight people do when they go through puberty at an earlier age. That really, I think, kicked off my really poor relationship with food. I had gained quite a bit of weight and there were concerns about how early I was like developing. I have this vivid memory of going to a dietitian at 9 years old and being made to track my food and count calories, which as a 30-year-old in 2021, I think is the most disturbing and absurd thing to have a 9-year-old do.
Yeah, that's so young. You're so impressionable.
So impressionable. And to be told there's something wrong with how much space you're taking up, change how you are at nine.
And be hyper aware of food and your body.
Yes, I was made to be hyper aware of food. Even after, you know, I kind of stopped seeing that dietitian, you know, I journaled for most of my life. In some childhood journals, I see where I was like, I ate this today, I ate this today. It's really sad because I was tracking how I was eating at that young of an age. And like 9 and 10 year olds shouldn't be worried about that.
Right.
I was always active. Which now I'm looking back, was like, oh, that was the hyperactivity part of the ADHD. I did like 4 different kinds of dance. I did soccer, I did basketball, I did equestrian sports.
Wow.
So I was always active, but I was always still chubby. But again, I was healthy.
Yeah.
And active. I think it really got bad when I was having some problems with an abusive stepdad. Really reached a peak when I was about 15, I also was doing competitive dance. So no matter how good I was at dance, I was still like the biggest girl there. And I think not having control at home and feeling sort of othered in my athletic of choice, things got really bad. That's when I was withholding food to a point where it looked like I was eating normally. That would have been normally for someone who wasn't doing, you know, 3-4 hour dance classes and then going to go do work at a barn on the weekends. And like, if I were sedentary, it would have been okay. So I had something that's called relative energy deficiency in sport.
Yeah, I was just going to ask how that affected your energy levels.
So even though it looked like a relatively normal amount of food, it was not for what I was asking of my body. So I was really fortunate. My mom wasn't retired then, but she's a retired physician. And she noticed, like, I haven't going to buy menstrual products lately. Are you okay? Because I messed up my cycle.
Yeah.
Starving myself. I stress fractured my foot. So she was like, okay, we've got to do something. So there's more monitoring, there's more therapy. I got put on antidepressants, which now I understand why they made me feel weird because of the ADHD, which was an easy mistake to assume I was depressed. Things got better. But when I was 19, I learned that I had a genetic mutation that causes my blood to clot really fast. It's the opposite of hemophilia. It's called thrombophilia. And I nearly died of pulmonary embolisms.
Oh, wow.
And that's when I relapsed. And that was worse than the first time. It was absolutely out of control. I started gaining weight because with my clotting disorder, hormonal contraceptives that were helping my polycystic ovarian syndrome were keeping my weight off. And I couldn't take those anymore. And I couldn't breathe. Well, so I couldn't do all this movement that brought me so much joy. I did therapy after that because obviously I was going through a lot, nearly dying before I was 20. I sort of fell into, like, I became a vegan at 17 and I had stopped cooking after my clots. And I think that changed my relationship with food. So after my clots, I was like, okay, I broke up with this boyfriend who was weird about my weight gain and had his own issues. I moved in with the man who's now my husband at 21. And I just accepted, this is my body now. There's more of me, but I'm healthy, I'm alive, that's it. And I think that's the place in my recovery where I really found the most tenable strategies that in therapy. And just a couple years ago, I actually got natural treatment for my polycystic ovarian syndrome and a bunch of weight just kind of fell off. And I got really scared. Am I going to relapse again?
But
I'm eating how I like, and I'm cooking and I'm making delicious food and like everything's great. But now I'm at, I think, the healthiest I've ever been in my life, both physically, as far as understanding what I need for recovery. So right before COVID, I actually went to go see a dietitian because my goal for my 30s is to compete in a triathlon. So I think I started this pandemic kind of on the right foot with food, having a professional tell me, you're doing great. Keep eating these things. I'm so proud of you.
Wow. Yeah, it does seem like it was those traumatic events that made you feel out of control. And there was a pattern to that. But then there was a traumatic event that kind of changed the game for you, accepting your body, starting to cope with that and go into recovery. So bittersweet, I guess you can say.
Yeah, like with the clots, I had felt like my body had betrayed me. It was no fault of my own. So I think understanding, like, you need to take care of this body. You almost lost it.
Yeah.
I took it to a different level, like an understanding that I don't think I could have had before.
Yeah, that makes sense. So is there anything else that you want to cover about your story with food before we move on?
Just that progression isn't linear. I'm at the best place I've ever been in recovery. But going forward, I realized I might have been one traumatic event away from another relapse.
Right.
I felt like being on meds now, I kind of understand how tenuous my grasp was on that, even though I felt really confident that it was okay.
Yeah. Again, like you said, it's not like this destination where you've made it and you're fine, because it is just next right thing, one thing at a time. It's a constant process and journey of coping with it. And when little things come up that are triggering, or you losing some weight when you were on a new medication, like that could have been triggering, but being able to like have that self-awareness and that self-reflection is huge. Okay, so we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about what your day-to-day experience with ADHD looks like. Can you describe the thoughts, the feelings, the different situations you're constantly facing with ADHD?
Well, to preface, nobody with ADHD is a monolith. So
yes,
everyone has their own like little trail mix of symptoms and severity. So some of the things I have, other people may not have, and mine may be, you know, less severe or more severe. So it's just is my own experience. But I think like I've been asking my husband a lot of really weird questions about, does your brain do this? Does your brain do this? I think the best way I can describe what it's like in my head any given day is like you're at the TV section of an electronics store or like a Best Buy, and all the TVs have the volume on and they're all playing different things. And I have no control over what they play. They don't turn off at night, which is why like nearly half people with ADHD have chronic sleep issues. And certain things may turn the volume down on the TVs for me. So like exercise may turn the volume down a little. Feeding my body what it needs may turn a couple TVs off. Good sleep may turn the volume down. Having a solid routine may turn off a few. Being on meds is like someone turned off half of them, and now I have just five TVs blaring instead of the whole wall. So it's still noisy in here, but certain things I do in my life help turn down the noise a little.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like before there were things that amplified it or turned the volume up or added TVs?
Definitely having my routine sort of wrecked at the beginning of this year. I had nowhere to go. And the reason routine helps is that people with ADHD have poor working memory. Working memory is kind of like the whiteboard in your head. So whenever you're like, I need to go to the kitchen and get a glass of water. And everyone's experience where you're like, wait, why did I go into the kitchen? But with ADHD, that's every day with simple tasks, because the working memory, someone's constantly going in and just erasing that whiteboard every time you focus on something else.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So executive dysfunction is a really big issue. So I actually saw a post recently that I think put it kind of nicely. Like some days my executive function is good and making coffee is just like put coffee in the coffee maker, put water in the coffee maker, turn coffee maker on. But some days someone's going through and erasing that whiteboard of my working memory so much, it's open coffee maker, put a filter in, turn on sink, fill up pitcher. It's broken down into 14 steps. And if I get interrupted at any point, I'm like, oh, what was I doing? Because with our brains, the part of our brain that controls impulses isn't communicating well with the part that controls long-term goals. So if my focus gets switched, I'm thrown out of that routine. So routine really helps. Exercise helps me a lot. So ADHD brains are low in dopamine, which is the reason that being on antidepressants made me feel weird, because I didn't need all that extra serotonin. My brain was like, I didn't order this. Please just give me dopamine.
Right.
So exercise gives you a dopamine boost. That helps me immensely, especially with mood regulation, which is hard for people with ADHD. So like I was saying before, my frustration threshold is really low. For people with ADHD, we have very intense emotions, like very big, big emotions. And that's been the symptom that the severity of has been the most disruptive for me, I think, because one of my meltdowns, I was like trying to vacuum and I finally got the executive function to vacuum and the vacuum got clogged. I'd spent probably 5 seconds trying to get it unclogged, couldn't do it. I had a meltdown and I crushed my metal trash can. I am not a large woman. I crushed my metal trash can. I got so mad. And then I started weeping because my husband loves that silly trash can.
Aww.
So when I exercise, it kind of helps me regulate those better so I can recognize I'm getting frustrated. It gives me more time between absolutely losing it and feeling the emotion to like access those things I learned in therapy to help me regulate.
That's interesting.
Even before I'm having the big feeling, it's like if I haven't exercised, I know I'm more likely to have a meltdown later. I think having that extra dopamine to bring me up to more of a baseline, I think it gives me just a little bit more of a lead time before the impulse takes over. So I say, okay, I need to sit, I need to get away, because sometimes I'll get mad. And like the one impulse I have all the time is if I get upset, my brain's like, throw your phone. Like, please don't throw your phone, throw your phone. Like, I'm mad, please don't wreck my phone. Things like exercise give me enough lead time. So I tell my husband, please take my phone. He's like, you want to eat your phone at the wall? I'm like, yes, please just take it away from me. I'm upset. Please take it away. I think the other thing is time blindness, which is kind of one of the hallmarks of ADHD. Mm-hmm. I have a really hard time judging how long things take, because with ADHD people, we have trouble with linear time. Neurotypical processes have a beginning, a middle, and an end. For an ADHD brain, ours are like now or never. Some people with ADHD tend to run really late. I am one of those people who have so overcompensated because I got such punishment for being late to things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the person who is like half an hour, 45 minutes early, and I'm just sitting there in the parking lot. So I completely misjudge how long things take. So I actually got a new scheduling app made for people with ADHD and autistic people.
Oh, really? What's it called?
It's pronounced Timo or Timo. It's T-I-I-M-O.
I'll have that in the show notes then.
There are no ads, so I don't get distracted. Kind of visually shows me how long I have instead of just throwing numbers at me, and like sends me reminders. So I'm like, oh no, I've been doing my skincare routine for how long? I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. So yeah, that's kind of how it affects every day. And then there are some parts that are really cool though. Hyperfocus is something that people with ADHD do. So if I'm interested in something, anybody with ADHD, you can sit there for hours without eating or drinking or going to the bathroom and just do it. Christmas Day, I finished a 6,000 page script for my own podcast.
Oh, wow.
From the rough draft to all my rewrites in 7 hours.
Wow. That's impressive.
Because it was interesting to me and I just sat there and did it, mm-hmm. which is really where I think the power with ADHD brains goes. I tend to do that with endurance sports also. So I can go into hyper focus and it's like, oh, how long have I been running? Kind of make up for that by doing a looped route so I don't run too far from the house. Hyperfixations are something. That's something we share with autistic people. If we have a special interest or hyperfixation, we're going to learn everything we can about it, which is cool because I can have a conversation with most people because I'm like, oh no, I know about this thing you like. I was obsessed with that in the summer of like 2010. If you ever need anyone for like Star Trek trivia or something, then my constant hyperfixation. In creativity, we're natural problem solvers. I can make random connections. I'm really good. I'm a dungeon master for D&D. Once a week, and I can make up stuff on the spot without having to take a minute. I've never had writer's block. I might not be writing the thing I need to be writing then, but I have certain parts of my podcast written that won't be ready to be in an episode till like 2022, but I'm still writing it in my brain. So yeah, it's not all like these bad things, like the intense emotions right. are good because I tend to deeply empathize with others. Like sometimes my friends will get good news and I start crying and I don't think it's something they cried about. So yeah, day-to-day sensory overload happens. So I'll get distracted by a smell that my husband's like, I don't know what you're smelling. The impulses, rejection sensitivity is another thing. We tend to really have a hard time with any critique. So if someone says, hey, you did a great job, but next time, could you try this? I'm like, oh no, I failed. They want me to try something different next time. Maybe I shouldn't do this anymore. So that is just complete rejection to me.
Interesting. Well, thank you. Thank you for giving us a glimpse into your life and how you process different things. I think it's really insightful. My mom and my sister below me both have ADHD and are diagnosed and take medication. But definitely hearing it from your perspective and hearing your experiences is even helping me gain like more empathy and understanding for what they are going through and, you know, how they process things that I might process differently. And it's frustrating for me when it's not bad. It's just different. So yeah, thank you again for like being here and sharing your story. I think it is so powerful and it is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. My husband's kind of doing the same thing. He's got a sibling and a parent with it. He's like, oh, that's why I'm understanding them better than how you're feeling right now. So I think there's something to be gained from being open.
Definitely. I'm having so many aha moments where I'm like, yeah, I can see that in them. I see when that happens. So let's talk about how these intersect. How has your eating disorder and your ADHD correlated or affected one another?
My psychiatrist basically put, like earlier when I was saying, boys or people who are assigned male at birth are given such leeway on these behaviors that are ADHD traits. And people who are assigned female at birth are not. So for people with ADHD, there reaches some point where you start to internalize that hyperactivity. When people who are assigned female at birth do that, they're doing it far earlier than their assigned male peers. Internalizing that hyperactivity I had, it goes into more racing thoughts. Someone turns on more TVs, and maybe some of these TVs have some really bad, like negative self-talk. These TVs are like a little more insidious. And when there's no outlet for that hyperactivity, you kind of seek control. When I was looking at how they correlate, there's been a lot more research the past few years on it. But the one that was most interesting, because it was right after mine first surfaced, was in 2007. It was found that teenage girls with ADHD were 4 times more likely to have an eating disorder than their neurotypical peers.
Oh, wow.
There's really a connection between adults with comorbid mental illness, like anxiety and depression. Like 50% of people with ADHD have some sort of comorbid mental illness. So yeah, for me, it was a lot of masking too. So masking is something people with ADHD and autistic people both do, because the way we're wired and the way we do things might get us in trouble or make neurotypical people uncomfortable. So when I'm having really big emotions and my peers aren't, maybe I need to not show that I'm having those. And understanding that my emotions I'm feeling more intensely than my peers makes bottling up my emotions even more volatile for me. And then sometimes, you know, having not a great stepdad and my grandmother wasn't so great, that I'd have what I know are meltdowns now, but they would interpret as tantrums.
Right.
And not to be given that compassion or the understanding to say, why is this happening? I was told things like, well, stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about.
Mm-mm.
Or they get punished. So I started masking these things really early on, to the point where I really think my emotional intelligence is kind of stunted, because sometimes I'll have a meltdown and I'm like, do I know what I'm feeling right now? It's not good, but I don't know what it is. So it's really common that after internalizing that, especially I'm 30, internalizing it that long, it finds a way to come out. Like, you want control. It's really common for that to happen, especially to people who are assigned female at birth, for them to develop eating disorders. Other forms of self-harm are really common for people with ADHD, but I was just shocked at how much eating disorders were common.
So I'm curious, with the hyperfixation on things, did you feel you had like a hyperfixation on your weight or your relationship with food and what you were eating, and having like racing thoughts? Yeah, just a hyperfixation on that. And that was filling your mind all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely it was. That's another reason it's probably so insidious for people with ADHD, because we very intensely hyperfixate on our bodies and food. I do think the thing that helped me switch gears was when I became vegan, the family was like, I'm not going to cook for you with these new foods. And I was like, okay, I'll learn to cook myself. Then my hyperfixation, it changed to not, what are you putting in your body? How is it affecting how your body's working? It was, oh, I'm going to learn about these foods from around the world. I'm going to learn how to cook these things. It definitely shifted.
So you were able to kind of like channel that in a different direction so that it wasn't harming you.
Yeah. I still have a hyperfixation on food, but it's not so much as me punishing my body or having control. It's, I want to learn how to make this. I want to learn mm-hmm. how to do this. I'm the friend who has just incredibly large spread just for game night now. So yeah, it did feed into it for sure.
So knowing the things you know now about ADHD and about your eating disorder and how they intersect, how have you been moving forward in healing and recovery, and what coping skills in particular work for you?
I think the one thing I'm having to come to terms with is that being neurodivergent in a world that caters to a neurotypical brain inherently carries a lot of trauma.
Yeah.
Especially for folks who are diagnosed later in life. So I think recognizing that is step number one. There are certain things that I've done from the beginning of my recovery that still are super important. Cognitive behavioral therapy and talk therapy, I think, are the reason I managed to do so well past 15 years. And I think always acknowledging when I am having an intrusive thought. The one incredible thing about being on the medication is it's like someone has just turned that volume down nearly to zero for the entire time the meds are in my system. So those intrusive thoughts just don't want to come in while my meds are in my system. And I hadn't known a moment of peace like that with food, I think, from the time I was 9 and I had to start tracking food.
Wow.
My husband was celebrating the day I first was on the meds because I was feeling really good. And he ordered takeout from one of my favorite places. And I just like finished my food and I cried. And it was a happy cry. All I thought was, I'm so glad I ordered that veggie burger. It was so good. And that's all I'm feeling right now. That's literally all I'm feeling. I'm going to hold on to that feeling of just being happy that I ate something I enjoyed.
Right. Free from like the thoughts of shame or wanting to control or all the other things that come with an eating disorder.
So now that I have this context and this comparison, it's helping me when they do drift back in, like sometimes they'll kind of drift back in after my meds have worn off at the end of the day, but instead of just like busting in like the Kool-Aid man, they just kind of float in and I'm like, okay, I know you're a lie. I knew you're a lie from the beginning, but now I really know you're a lie because I know what the truth feels like. I'll accept that they're temporary. I accept that they're going to leave and I'm just going to continue working on doing the opposite. And then I usually share them with my husband. They lose their power when they exist somewhere outside of my own brain. So no, they don't deserve to have that power over me. So I will voice them to him. And then cooking helps me. When those thoughts are telling me, you know, you don't deserve to eat this. It's like, well, I'm going to make something really delicious. You can't do anything about it. So I think that's been a really good outlet. But as far as ADHD, my big project is to work on not masking anymore. I don't know if it's the fact that I decided I was going to work on it or that it's just been quite a week for it. But I feel like I'm being tested on that and having to be really honest with how I'm feeling with a lot of people in my life. So I'm going to let my self feel those big emotions. Realize that I'm not overreacting. I feel them intensely and I'm reacting exactly the way my brain wants to. And I'm going to just stop burying those emotions. I'm working on my own emotional intelligence more. There's an app I really like called the Mood Meter. And basically, I tell it, oh, no, this feeling is bad. I have a lot of energy and this feeling is bad. And it helps me sort of like narrow down exactly what that feeling is and like name it precisely and claim it and understand why I'm feeling it. So yeah. I've been doing a lot of work on that. But the big thing is just stop internalizing my hyperactivity also. Stop shrinking myself for the comfort of neurotypical people. There's nothing wrong with how I am. I'm going to continue living like that. I'm going to be honest and advocate for myself when I have a need for something because of how my brain's wired.
Right.
I'm not going to be worried about being an inconvenience. Like, I'm just going to stare that ableism in the face and say, no, I can't do that. Sorry, I'm going to sit in the back. I'm going to crack my knuckles. Probably going to be walking around. I'm not going to continue internalizing those things. Try not to feel guilty.
I think you're incredible. To me, it sounds like instead of suppressing what makes you you, you're channeling it in new ways that work for you. And I just think that's beautiful. And I admire you and I admire all the work you're doing.
Thank you. I think I'm going to be a better friend because of it. I think I'm already a better spouse because of it. Like, I think he's getting to know me better than he's ever known me before. And
right.
In seventh grade, learning something new about me is kind of not that easy. And I think I'm a better artist for it, too. I think it's going to really translate into what I love to do even more.
Yeah, absolutely. And to me, it also sounds like you've really started to educate yourself on the subject and just done your research, because I know that for me, that has been a really validating and empowering and healing experience with the different things I've gone through. I just dove headfirst into reading books and listening to podcasts and articles and following people online. And again, it was just like so validating hearing other people's stories and learning about the different things I've gone through or how I work. And it's empowering to be able to know that, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. You can function and you can live like a fulfilling, beautiful life. And so if you have any resources or things that you want to share or tips for someone that wants to educate themselves on these subjects, that would be great.
I think my most valuable resource has just been following people on Instagram too. And it's weird because a lot of them are comic artists and My background is comics, and one of them is even named Brianne. Yeah, so there have been a few comic strips that I really like that just are really validating because of how you feel. I think ADHD Alien is one of my favorites because there's a continuing sort of theme that people with ADHD feel like an alien. I know that everyone's brain doesn't work exactly the same way. I was like, I do feel like an alien sometimes. And then ADHD Brie has been really good, and she was diagnosed later in life. And there's just a whole community online, and it's really supportive. And it's really about like, hey, let's channel how your brain works into something incredible. This is what's worked for me.
That's amazing. So to kind of wrap up, what do you want listeners to take away from this episode? And what would you say to someone else struggling with this?
I would make sure, just to be clear, that not everyone with ADHD has an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Everyone with an eating disorder has ADHD. But if anything resonated with you, or you did what I did and you said, well, I thought everyone worked that way. Sadly, it's a privilege to be able to go see a mental health professional. But if you have the privilege to do that and any of that resonated with you, please see if you can get screened. It's so common for people with ADHD to have eating disorders or substance abuse issues. And the mortality rate for both is just painfully high. And if you can figure out how your brain's working and figure out what you're trying to make up for by both of those things, it could save you. If you have even the slightest, if you see yourself at all in what I've said, please go get screened by a professional. Just understanding how your brain works is a really big first step. Medication is effective for 80% of people with ADHD. 20% is still a lot of people it doesn't work for, but there's still so many things you can do to make things better. So I really think if any of it resonates, please go get checked out. And then for neurotypical people, please be patient with people you know with ADHD and maybe evaluate why your kids are having a meltdown. Is it a meltdown or is it a tantrum? Because I really wish someone would have known the difference. When I was a kid, tantrums are goal oriented and they end as soon as the kid realizes they're not going to get what they want or they get what they want. If what's happening to your kid doesn't fit that, evaluate what's happening because you don't want them to be 30 and have an eating disorder and to be crushing their trash can like the Hulk.
Right. It just doesn't hurt to explore things further if you have an inkling that you might.
It's just a questionnaire. It's going to take maybe a couple hours of your life. If the questionnaire seems too short and it doesn't follow you from like birth to now, run the other direction. But make sure you see someone who does handle adult ADHD because some people will not.
Gotcha. That's some great reminders and tips and just an overall message. So if people want to reach out, connect with you, see your work, where can they find you?
If anyone wants to reach out to work with me, luckywinnershow@gmail.com is probably the best email. My personal Instagram is Brianne_Leeson. And, you know, that's going to have a lot of ADHD random thoughts and conversations on there. So just be prepared. And then, yeah, my podcast is called Today's Lucky Winner. I just think like if anything I've said today has resonated with you, and you'd like something funny that maybe makes you feel a little less alone, I think that's my goal. I write the show because it's a show I wish I could listen to. Sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but
no.
But yeah, today's lucky winner, and it's at Lucky Winner Show on social media.
Awesome. So
that's what I do.
I will have those linked in the show notes along with all of the resources that you've provided. So thank you. So to finally wrap up, I always end my episodes with a little song recommendation because I love my music. So I just want to ask you, do you have a song that resonates with you and your story?
I do. It is called Charity by Youngblood. I listened to him before my diagnosis. And then after my diagnosis, I was like, oh my God, does he have ADHD? And it does really resonate with me. Yeah. So Charity by Youngblood is my recommendation.
So why that song in particular?
I think it resonates with me trying to accept that I have really big feelings. Having feelings is tantamount to breathing, and I have been holding my breath up until now. So just repressing these intense emotions, it's been making me sick, and it's been making me angry, and sometimes it's been making me feel nothing. I feel like the song is just embracing these traits, and it's about claiming every feeling you have.
That's beautiful. Thank you. And thank you again for being here today, taking the time out of your day to share this message with us and being so open and honest with your story. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I was so happy to be here.
Of course. All right. That's all we have for you guys today. Thanks for listening and tune in next time. I hope this podcast left you feeling empowered, better understood, and less alone in this crazy thing called life. If you like what you hear, leave a rating or review and share it with your friends. Thanks for listening and tune in next time.